All right, here I am with, I don't know if we say famous or infamous,
both
Richard Gaines, how long has it been that you've taken over the waterfront beat with the Times now?
A little more than a year.
A little more than a year. And you've thrown yourself headlong into this and really taken it seriously because it's so complex. I mean, people within the industry have given up trying to understand it. What is it that has motivated you to try to wrap your arms or mind around this crazy complex industry, and what is it that motivated you to take on the assignment?
It needed to be done. It was a failing of the newspaper for a long time. It just didn't have anybody who was trying to understand the waterfront and the economy and the fishing and the harbor. And against the enormous power, almost unfettered, of the federal government to do what it wanted, the fishermen and the fishing industry were playing under rules that they could not win by. The need for the press was so powerful, and you could see the dysfunction in the industry. And nothing was working right. It was horrible mistrust. People were having their lives ruined. Prosecutions were being undertaken for almost impossible reasons, inconceivable injustices. So this was a failing that the newspaper had to redress. And finally, I realized the only way to do it was to do it totally, complete immersion. And you can't have two main focuses. You have to have one, and especially here, and because it's so hard to understand and it takes so much time. So I just said I'm going to do this and do nothing else. And Ray Lamont, the editor, was good with it, and the people who the publishers and the higher ups were good with it, and it also plays into my obsessive compulsive personality.
Well, I'll tell you, the fishermen appreciate it. I mean, they say that you're getting a lot, 90% of it right, and I think that's better than most anybody could get right.
Well, part of the problem is that it is difficult.
Well, you have
a difficult system to understand. It doesn't work the way land-based systems work. The economy is diffuse. It's not logical. It doesn't make sense. It's enormously spread out. The people are, at sea by nature, and you just can't walk down a main street and say, I know what that is. I know what that is. I know what that is. Look at this stuff here. It's going to go out and do things at some point, and it's going to mostly be, impossible to see it. So it's just...
We were talking a little while ago, and we were talking about, the Michael and Kristen. Now, he's an offshore lobster, but we're talking about all the different layers and subsets of fishing within fishing.
And then you got the recreational fishermen.
Yep.
Who are being regulated now they're sharing the same fishery as the commercial fishermen, and there's tremendous tension there between the federal government and the recreational fishermen and the commercial fishermen, and all the rules are changing constantly.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got an industry, and the model, the business model for the industry is never the same for 6 months at a time.
Yeah.
How can you stay in business? How can you plan your business if you don't know what the business model, the regulatory model is going to be?
It's how do you make a financial investment, right? I mean, it's just crazy.
And the more I've sort of learned little bits at a time about the fishing industry, the more I've come to have sort of a basic thesis about it. I mean, I kind of believe that this is going to be Gloucester's future too. Mm-hmm. That fishing is what Gloucester has always done and is going to continue doing. As long as there is fishing to be done in the Western Pacific, Western Atlantic, I think it'll be done primarily out of Gloucester and New Bedford.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in a state of mortal danger right now and undergoing enormous change, and it needs to be written about, and the public needs to understand it as well as possible, because that's what Gloucester is.
Yeah. Well, you've done a phenomenal job, and now you. I'm gonna ask you some questions now. You talk about the little guy,
yeah.
And you talk about injustice and what motivates you and what drives you and what you don't like, but what you enjoy, what motivates you. Why don't we talk about that? How you're talking about that you think that this, what you like to go after and what you like to expose.
There are injustices all over the place. We'll never run out of them.
Yeah.
And what I do is I have a commission, and I've got the protection of the First Amendment. And the First Amendment protection kind of obligates you to use it, and use it as well as you can. It's just, I've been doing this all my life. I started doing newspapers when I was a junior in high school. It got me out of going to class. It was a lot more fun. And so I kind of look at it as, you know, I've got this commission, and I've got the First Amendment, and I'm going to use it. You know, I'm going to use it aggressively wherever I can, and try to tell people stories that that they want to read, and helps them understand a little bit about the world that they live in. And you know, it's good for my business. The people who give me the commission think this is good for the newspaper. That helps them sell newspapers. Newspapers. Are essential, and they're as much danger or more danger than fishing boats today. So I'm just trying to demonstrate that, you know, there's still a tremendous need and an appetite for good news.
Yeah.
Good news in the sense of important stories, stuff that people put some value in learning.
Now you have some young people. You have some young photographers. You have that Pat.
Everybody around me is young these days.
Yeah, and I mean, and what is it like in the newsroom? I mean, is there a feeling of like this is important what we're doing, but you know that, you know, you're competing in an industry that's under extreme duress. I mean, what is it like in the thing there in the newsroom? And what do you tell the young kids that are coming up?
I don't tell them much. I think that you impart your personality, your attitude, your point of view, your way of thinking about things, the logic that you bring into problem solving. It's more mentoring in the sense of working together, working on parallel tracks, doing the same thing with in different subject areas every day. And people who are older and have more experience at it should sort of have a kind of a power to influence, just by, you know, you watch how it's done.
Mm-hmm.
And people pick up, this is the right way to do it, this is the wrong way to do it.
What are the right reasons to get into journalism?
I think if you look at every dysfunctional part of America today, wherever there's dysfunction, you'll also find failure of the First Amendment, Fourth Estate, the press. The America democracy needs an independent press. Otherwise, the public cannot possibly have a good idea what's going on, and if they don't know what's going on, they feel hopeless, powerless. They throw up their hands, and they have no way to attack problems. And there are so many problems, and it always have been, always will be. So somebody has got to have to go around, and without a vested interest and without a hidden agenda, say, this is how this works. and it doesn't work very well, but that's the way it works, and if you deal with
it. Hold on one sec. Okay, good. Yep, go ahead.
And
so would I be correct in saying then the reason to get into journalism is because you feel it's obviously not for money nowadays.
No,
it's almost a service.
It's a calling.
A calling.
In many ways, it's a calling. It's if you enjoy fighting with bullies, if you enjoy fighting with hypocrites, if you enjoy finding people who have inspiring stories to tell. I mean, it's not all just finding bad people,
yep,
bad things. There are just as many good stories.
Yeah.
People doing inspiring work, solving problems, living ways that should be inspiring to other people, then that's also a part of it. It's taking the moving picture of life and putting it into little segments that people can read. This is how people understand their world.
Yeah, you really love living here, don't you? We've had this discussion before, but
this is where I was meant to be, and this is what I was meant to do. And I am very conscious of how lucky and fortunate I am. I'm doing exactly what I want to do, exactly.
All right, Richard, can we go back and say how your love affair with Gloucester started?
Yeah, you can. I mean, that much is real easy. It started back in the late 1940s. My grandfather was a businessman in Brighton, in Boston, and he got a cottage out at the Moreland. They had a big hotel on Atlantic Road, at Moreland Road, and he had cottages, and he rented a cottage so he could have his daughter, my mother, and me, my family come up from New York and spend the summers with him. So I came up here every summer from the age of 2 or 3 or something. You know, I don't know, it was 46, 47, 48, something like that.
Yeah.
And would spend these idyllic two-month segments of every year here. And when you summer here, you know, by definition, it's all fun and games.
Right.
You know, you don't have to work.
Yep.
You know, you worry about whether it's going to rain or whether you should go, you know, fish or
that's
today
the big
or
dilemma.
Go to the beach or go, you know, blueberry picking or what, you know. And so I got to see Gloucester in these like 2 month segments every year, and it's real easy to fall in love with this place. I mean, it's a summer place mostly, you know. I mean, ultimately Gloucester shines in the summer.
Yeah.
And so all I knew was that this was heaven on earth. And then life goes on, and
you cut your teeth in Boston, right?
Yeah, I ended up starting my working career in Boston, even though I grew up in New York.
Yeah.
And
you were with the Phoenix for how many years?
I was with UPI from 1968 to 75, and then I was with the Phoenix from 75 to 89, and
wow.
Bounced around for a while, and needed to find a place to live, and saw a little ad for this little place in up in the woods in Bayview 10 years ago, and it was like, you know, something from heaven.
Yeah.
And I said, come back. And so I came back, and so I'm doing what I've always loved doing, and I'm doing it, you know, in the place that I've loved the longest of any place on face of the earth. So I don't know, how does somebody get to be that lucky?
Yeah.
You know, it's the only thing I say is that I go to, not a day goes by where I don't say, oh, you know what, I'm so lucky, I'm so blessed, this is doing what I want to do
in the
where
place.
I want to do
yeah.
it. And I've never had more fun, and I just consider myself enormously lucky. To be here, standing on the dock with you, talking about this, looking into your camera.
Hey, Richard, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.